This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Missoula, Rape and the Justice System in a College Town by John Krakauer. Read for you by Mojan Marnot. Rape is unique. No other violent crime is so fraught with controversy, so enmeshed in dispute and in the politics of gender and sexuality. And within the domain of rape, the most highly charged area of debate concerns the issue of false allegations. For centuries, it has been asserted and assumed that women cry rape, that a large proportion of rape allegations are maliciously concocted for purposes of revenge or other motives. David Lisak, Lori Gardiner, Sarah C. Nixa, and Ashley M. Cote. False Allegations of Sexual Assault, Violence Against Women, December 2010.
Author's note. Rape is a much more common crime than most people realize, and women of college age are most frequently the victims. According to a special report issued by the U.S. Department of Justice in December 2014, for the period 1995 to 2013, females ages 18 to 24 had the highest rate of rape and sexual assault victimizations compared to females in all other age groups. The report estimated that 0.7% of this high-risk cohort are sexually assaulted each year, approximately 110,000 young women. This survey was primarily concerned with documenting crime rates, however, and relied on a relatively narrow definition of sexual assault. Notably, respondents to the DOJ survey were not asked about incidents in which they might have been incapable of providing consent while incapacitated by drugs or alcohol. A different federal agency, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, released a report in September 2014 that examined the problem of sexual violence from a public health perspective rather than a criminal justice perspective, and paid more attention to sexual assaults involving drugs and alcohol. It generated quite different numbers. Using data gathered in 2011, the CDC study estimated that across all age groups, 19.3% of American women have been raped in their lifetimes, and that 1.6% of American women, nearly 2.5 million individuals, reported that they were raped in the 12 months preceding the survey. As the dissimilar results from these two government surveys suggest, it is impossible to state with certainty how many women are raped each year. Quantifying the prevalence of sexual assault is a highly speculative exercise, because at least 80% of those who were assaulted don't report the crime to authorities. This book is an effort to understand what deters so many rape victims from going to the police, and to comprehend the repercussions of sexual assault from the perspective of those who have been victimized. To that end, I have written about a rash of sexual assaults in a single American city, Missoula, Montana, from 2010 through 2012. The victims of these assaults happened to be female college students, but young women who were not enrolled in college are probably at even greater risk, and it's not just young women, or just women, for that matter, who were in danger of being raped. The CDC report cited above estimated that approximately 2.5 million American men alive today will be raped in their lifetimes, 1.7% of the male population. The research for this book included interviews with victims, their families and acquaintances, and, when possible, the men accused of assaulting the women I wrote about, but I didn't speak with every victim or every alleged assailant. To learn as much as I could, and to corroborate what sources told me, I spoke at length with eminent psychologists and lawyers, attended court proceedings, read thousands of pages of court transcripts, court filings, emails, letters, police reports, and documents generated by university disciplinary proceedings, listened to recordings of police interviews and university disciplinary proceedings, and reviewed newspaper articles, the findings of government investigations, and scientific papers published in peer-reviewed journals. Whenever dialogue occurs in the program that follows, it is a verbatim quote from a person speaking, a verbatim quote from a source recounting what he or she heard the speaker say, a verbatim quote from a recording of an official proceeding, or a verbatim quote from a transcript of an official proceeding. Parts of the book may be difficult to hear. Some of the events I describe are extremely disturbing. Additionally, there is a sprawling cast of characters, several of whom have been given pseudonyms to protect their privacy. John Krakauer, February 2015.
Part 1. Allison. Now, should we treat women as independent agents responsible for themselves? Of course. But being responsible has nothing to do with being raped. Women don't get raped because they were drinking or took drugs. Women do not get raped because they weren't careful enough. Women get raped because someone raped them. Jessica Valenti, The Purity Myth. Chapter 1. Office Solutions and Services, a Missoula office products company, didn't have its 2011 Christmas party until January 6, 2012. As a counterpoint to the chilly Montana evening, the staff decorated the place in a Hawaiian motif. Around 9 p.m., 30 or 40 people, employees and their families mostly, were chatting, playing party games, and sipping beverages from red plastic cups in a room overlooking the parking lot, when a shiny Chrysler 300 sedan pulled up and rolled to a stop in front of the floor-to-ceiling windows, attracting the attention of the revelers. Two well-dressed men with dour expressions got out of the vehicle and stood beside it. "It was a really nice black car," recalls Kevin Huguet, the owner of Office Solutions. As he was admiring the Chrysler, one of Huguet's salesmen asked, "Who are those guys?" Huguet had no idea, so he walked outside and asked, "Can I help you?" "We're Missoula police detectives," the man who had been driving the car replied. "I just need to talk to Allison." "Allison is my daughter," Huguet said, his hackles rising. "You're going to have to tell me a little more than that." "Dad, it's okay," 22-year-old Allison Huguet interjected, having walked out to the parking lot shortly after her father. Detective Guy Baker, who is 6'5" and weighs 250 pounds, peered down at Allison, a slender woman with bright eyes and a ponytail. "I need to talk to you," he said. "We don't have to do this in front of your dad. How do you want us to handle this?" He and Allison walked away from the car to speak privately, while Detective Mark Blood remained behind with Kevin Huguet. "Hey," Baker said to Allison in a warmer voice when they'd moved a short distance away. They'd become acquainted 4 years earlier, during her final year of high school, when she asked him to serve as her mentor for a school project. It had been a positive experience for both of them. Explaining why he'd shown up during the company Christmas party, he said, "I thought it was important to tell you in person as soon as possible. About an hour ago, I arrested Bo Donaldson. I got a full confession from him, and he is in jail." Allison's eyes brimmed with tears of relief. Over by the Chrysler, Kevin Huguet grew impatient as he watched Allison and Baker conferring. "You know what?" he told Detective Blood after a few minutes. "I want to know what's going on here. This is my daughter, and I want to know what's going on." Kevin abruptly strode away and confronted Baker. "She didn't do anything bad," Baker said. "It's not like that." Then Baker turned to Allison and said, "I think you really need to talk to your dad and tell him." Allison faced her father and in a shaky voice declared, "Bo raped me." Kevin stood on the cold pavement, gobsmacked. Struggling to make sense of the words his daughter had just spoken, he wrapped his arms around her. As he hugged Allison and began to process what Bo Donaldson had done to her, Kevin's shock and confusion turned into blinding rage. "I thought he was going to find Bo and kill him or something," Allison told me, recalling the events of that night. Bo Donaldson, a junior at the University of Montana at the time of the assault, was on the school's football team. Allison Huguet was attending Eastern Oregon University on a track scholarship. They had grown up together in Missoula and had been inseparable friends since the first grade, but the relationship had never been romantic. Donaldson often referred to Huguette as his little sister, and the sentiment was reciprocated. Throughout her childhood and adolescence, Huguette regarded Donaldson as the brother she never had. For the previous 16 years, Huguette's parents had welcomed Donaldson into their home as if he were a member of their family. "You spend your whole life when you have kids protecting them," Kevin Huguette told me. "But who thinks their daughter's trusted friend is actually a monster who is going to hurt them in the night?" Allison was as angry as her father, but a confounding mix of other emotions had supplanted her rage. Donaldson raped her on September 25, 2010. She had waited 15 months, suffering in silence before going to the police. During that period, she told nobody beyond her mother and three or four close friends that she had been raped. Not even her father or sisters knew about it. Such reticence, it turns out, is common among victims of sexual assault. No more than 20% of rapes are reported to the police, a statistic that defies comprehension until one looks closely at how sexual assault cases are adjudicated in the United States. Montana is a huge place with relatively few people. Although Missoula is the state's second largest city, it only has 70,000 residents. Congenial and picturesque, it's the kind of community that charms first-time visitors into putting money down on real estate within hours of arriving. Some 42% of the population has a bachelor's degree or higher, compared to 28% of the rest of the nation. Good restaurants and lively bars abound. The legendary trout stream, the Clark Fork, runs fast and clear through the heart of downtown, paralleled by an abandoned railroad right-of-way that's been transformed into a bucolic thoroughfare for cyclists, joggers, and strollers. South of the river, the city's unpresuming neighborhoods stretch across a broad valley, above which five mountain ranges converge. From Missoula's origins in the mid-19th century until the late decades of the 20th, the local economy depended heavily on timber cut from the surrounding high country. About 35 years ago, however, the forest products industry began to fall on hard times. Most of the sawmills closed, and loggers in caulk boots and tin pants became an endangered species. A behemoth pulp mill pumped $45 million annually into the local economy, and at times created a noxious smog that settled so densely over the city that drivers had to turn on their headlights in the middle of the day, until 2009, when it was shuttered and sold for scrap. Presently, the largest employer in the Missoula Valley is the University of Montana by a large margin. With its 15,000 students and more than 800 faculty members, UM, as it is known, has left a deep imprint on the city. Missoula has a much higher proportion of Democrats, for instance, than the state as a whole. As locals like to joke, one of the things that's so great about living in Missoula is that it's only 20 minutes from Montana. Despite its liberal bent, in many ways Missoula resembles the other cities of similar size in the Rocky Mountain region. Its population is 92% white, 2% Native American, 2% Hispanic, and less than 1% African American. The median family income is $42,000. 20% of the population lives below the poverty line. Among Missoulians, there is strong support for the right to keep and bear arms, and for limiting the role of the federal government in their affairs. Missoula has a culture uniquely its own, however, thanks to the fusion of its gritty frontier heritage with the university's myriad impacts. UM has nationally distinguished programs in biology and ecology, and is perhaps even more renowned for its literary bona fides. The faculty of the university's creative writing program, founded in 1920, has included such influential authors as Richard Hugo, James Crumley, and William Kittredge. Reminiscing in one of his incomparable essays about what drew him to Missoula for the first time, Kittredge wrote, "I was looking for what I took to be a genuine world to inhabit. I wanted to be someone that I could understand and stand." A romantic idea that seems commonplace in the West these days. The Northern Rockies seemed like an undiscovered land, thick with secrets no one could bother to keep. During a drunken visit to Missoula to go fishing with Kittredge in 1972, Raymond Carver, the godfather of minimalist fiction, fell head over heels in love with both the town and Diane Cecily, the university's director of publications. Richard Ford, the Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist, resided in Missoula for 3 or 4 very productive years in the 1980s, and is recalled with pride by its citizenry. The literary figure most closely identified with the town, however, is Norman MacLean, the author of A River Runs Through It, the semi-autobiographical work of fiction set in Missoula and on the nearby Big Blackfoot River, from which the Academy Award-winning film starring Brad Pitt was adapted. But never mind Kittredge or Ford or the Big Blackfoot. Missoulian's greatest source of civic pride, hands down, is the University of Montana football team, the beloved Grizzlies of the Big Sky Conference, who won the football championship subdivision national title in 1995 and 2001. Their record of 12 straight conference titles prior to 2010 was the second longest streak in NCAA Division I history. In 1985, a billionaire Missoula construction magnate named Dennis Washington donated $1 million to build Washington Grizzly Stadium, a beautiful facility that seats 25,200 and is filled to capacity for almost every home game. The Grizzlies' overall record from the opening of the stadium through 2011 was a remarkable 174 wins and 24 losses. The Grizz don't play at the same elite level as college football colossi like Florida State, Ohio State, and Alabama. It's fair to say that the team's win-loss record would be much less impressive if they played under the bright lights of the Big Ten or the Southeastern Conference, instead of in a backwater like the Big Sky. Be that as it may, the Grizzlies inspire the same kind of fanaticism in Missoula as the Seminoles do in Tallahassee and the Crimson Tide does in Tuscaloosa. UM fans call themselves Grizz Nation. Missoula is Grizzlyville. It would be hard to overstate the degree to which Grizz football is exalted by the residents of western Montana. Recent events, however, have forced at least some Missoulians to reconsider their veneration of all things Grizz. In December 2010, 4 of Bo Donaldson's teammates on the UM football team allegedly gang-raped a female student when she was too drunk to resist, and because the football players claimed the sex was consensual, they were not charged with a crime. A year later, in December 2011, 3 Grizz football players sexually assaulted 2 female students after allegedly drugging them. None of these assailants was prosecuted either. When the latter incident was brought to light by the local newspaper, UM President Royce Engstrom appointed the Honorable Diane Barrs, who in 1989 became the first woman to serve on the Montana Supreme Court, to launch an investigation. In a preliminary report released to the public on December 31, 2011, Barrs wrote, "This investigation has revealed evidence of non-consensual sex that is not being reported in the university system. The university is required to take immediate and appropriate action." In Barrs's final report, completed on January 31, 2012, she identified 9 sexual assaults by UM students, not all of whom were football players, from September 2010 through December 2011. At the top of the list was the rape of Allison Huguet by Bo Donaldson. Barrs warned, "The reports of sexual assaults on the UM campus now require immediate action and swift compliance with Title IX mandates. A rape-tolerant campus with ineffective programming, inadequate support service for victim survivors, and inequitable grievance procedures threatens every student. Acts of sexual violence are vastly underreported on college campuses, and a victim of sexual assault is likely to suffer from depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, substance abuse, and academic problems." Diane Barrs's report rattled Missoula. Then, just 3 months later, the U.S. Department of Justice revealed that it too was investigating the apparent epidemic of sexual assaults in western Montana. The feds announced that at least 80 alleged rapes had been reported in Missoula over the preceding 3 years, and that the DOJ would be scrutinizing assaults against all women in Missoula, not just university students. United States Attorney General Eric Holder noted, "The allegations that the University of Montana, the local police department, and the county attorney's office failed to adequately address sexual assault are very disturbing." The spate of rapes in Grizzlyville led to disquieting articles from such national publications as the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. But it was a 3,800-word dispatch posted on the website Jezebel 9 days after the DOJ announcement that perhaps did the most damage to Missoula's good name. Written by Katie J.M. Baker, it was titled My Weekend in America's So-Called Rape Capital, and the derogatory moniker went viral, prompting an outcry from Missoulians who believed it was unfair. Baker's tart, insightful piece indicated that she wasn't sure the description was deserved, however. Her headline was drawn from the article's second paragraph, in which she quoted a 20-year-old Missoula drug dealer who lamented, "People think we're the rape capital of America now," before immediately noting, "But we're not. Missoula is just like any other college town." In fact, 80 rapes over the course of 3 years appears to be on par with national averages for college towns of Missoula's size, as Baker mentioned in her piece. According to the FBI's latest statistics, there were an average of 26.8 forcible rapes reported in American cities the size of Missoula in 2012, which works out to be 80.4 rapes over 3 years. In other words, the number of sexual assaults in Missoula might sound alarming, but if the FBI figures are accurate, it's actually commonplace. Rape, it turns out, occurs with appalling frequency throughout the United States. Chapter 2. When Allison Huguette was 5 years old, her family moved from Kalispell, up near Glacier National Park, to Missoula, where they bought a home in a quiet neighborhood called Target Range, at the western edge of the city, near the confluence of the Bitterroot River and the Clark Fork. Huguette enrolled in the first grade at Target Range School and soon befriended Bo Donaldson. They remained close buddies for the next 12 years. Huguette and Donaldson graduated together in June 2008 from Big Sky High School, where both of them were good students and outstanding athletes. Huguette, who competed on the track team, was the Montana pole vault champion their senior year. Donaldson set 10 school records on the football field and was honored as the team's most valuable player. When Donaldson accepted a scholarship to play football at UM, it was deemed sufficiently important to merit an article in the Missoulian, the local newspaper. "I've always wanted to play for the Grizz," Donaldson told the paper. He had been recruited by a number of other schools, including Montana State University in Bozeman, the arch rival of the University of Montana. It was a big deal in Missoula when he decided to attend UM. Huguette was proud of Donaldson. "I always thought he was intelligent," she told me. "I was very happy for him when he got a scholarship. He came from a family where none of them had gone to college. Most didn't even graduate high school." For her part, Huguette left Montana after high school to attend Eastern Oregon University, where she was offered an athletic scholarship. She saw Donaldson only once or twice after she departed for college. On September 24, 2010, Huguette was living in Missoula at her mother's house and was getting ready to return to La Grande, Oregon, to begin her junior year at EOU. That evening, she received a call from her friend Keeley Williams, who suggested they go to a party at a house Bo Donaldson was renting in Missoula's University District. Williams had also grown up in the Target Range neighborhood and had known Huguette since Allison arrived in Missoula. After graduating from Big Sky High School in the same class as Huguette and Donaldson, Williams had left town to attend Portland State University and happened to be back for a week to visit her parents. When Williams told Huguette that most of the posse they'd hung out with since they were 6 years old would be at Donaldson's party, Huguette enthusiastically agreed that they should attend. Williams drove. Upon arriving at Donaldson's house at around 10 in the evening, they were happy to see many of their childhood soulmates. "When we walked downstairs, I immediately ran into Bo and hugged him," Huguette remembered. "It was a nice evening. Everyone was relaxed and having a good time. People played beer pong in the basement and held tea races to determine who could chug bottles of Twisted Tea, a brand of syrupy malt liquor favored by UM students, the fastest. It was a Friday night, and the Grizz football team would be playing Sacramento State University on Saturday afternoon, but Donaldson had suffered a serious ankle injury the previous summer and wouldn't be suiting up for the game. He was pounding down alcoholic beverages with gusto. Enjoying the company of seldom-seen friends, Huguette and Williams found themselves drinking more than they customarily did, too. By 1:30 in the morning, the party was running out of steam, and the handful of people still there moved upstairs to the living room, Donaldson and Huguette sat down together on a couch. Huguette, growing sleepy, lay across the couch, put a pillow on Donaldson's thigh, and placed her head on the pillow. "But there was nothing remotely sexual about it," said Huguette and Williams. Allison never had any interest in that type of relationship with Beau, Williams insisted. Absolutely none. Another classmate from their target range days, Sam Urschler, pseudonym, who lived in the house with Beau Donaldson, urged Keeley Williams and Allison Huguette not to drive home because they'd been drinking. "Which was nice of him," Huguette acknowledged. "That's how Sam is, kind of caring like that." He said, "Why don't you guys just stay here and sleep on the couch?" So we all agreed we would. Not long thereafter, Donaldson got up from the couch he was sharing with Huguette, went downstairs, and Huguette fell asleep on the couch alone, fully dressed. Huguette enjoyed sleeping on couches. Even when she was home, she often preferred to sleep on the couch instead of in her own bed. Williams, meanwhile, went in search of an empty bed and soon found one. "It was even made," she said. "I thought, if we have to stay here, this is where I'm going to sleep." After discovering the vacant bedroom, Williams went back to the living room to invite Huguette to join her. She shook Huguette awake and said, "Allie, do you want to come to bed? I'm sleeping in this room, and there's a bed." "No, I'm fine," Huguette groggily replied. "I'll just stay here." Williams got a blanket and placed it over her friend, then returned to the bedroom. When she left, Huguette was the only person remaining in the living room. Everyone else in the house seemed to be asleep. Huguette was awakened about 2 hours later. It was still dark. She was lying face down on the couch, and her jeans and underwear had been pulled down. "I remember waking up to Beau moaning, and a lot of pressure and pain," she later testified. Donaldson was on top of her, penetrating her vagina from behind with his penis. "I opened my eyes just partly," she remembered. "Just from his moaning, I could tell it was him." Although she was terrified, she forced herself to keep her eyes shut and wait for him to finish. Huguette is an elite athlete, and she'd taken self-defense classes. She was just 5 feet 5 inches tall, however, and weighed 130 pounds. Donaldson weighed 230 pounds and played both fullback and linebacker for an NCAA Division I football team. She assumed that if he was willing to rape her while she was sleeping, he wouldn't hesitate to harm her severely in order to keep her from resisting or calling for help. "He could have snapped my neck like a twig," Huguette told me. "So I just lay there and pretended to be asleep." Donaldson continued to rape Huguette for another 5 minutes before ejaculating inside her. He was not wearing a condom. When he'd finished, he tugged her jeans partly up, threw the blanket over her, and walked away without saying a word. Stunned, Huguette remained motionless until she was sure he was out of the room. Then, quietly, she gathered her shoes and her phone, tiptoed barefoot through the kitchen, exited the house via the back door, and started sprinting down a gravel alley to find help. When Donaldson had yanked Huguette's pants to her knees, he had torn off the button and mangled the zipper. So with one hand she simultaneously cradled her shoes and tried to hold her jeans up, while with her other she speed-dialed her boyfriend, running as fast as she could at the same time. "I don't know why I was calling him," Allison said. "He had moved to Colorado. It's not like he was going to be able to help. I guess I wasn't thinking too clearly. I called him twice, but he never answered." Still running, Allison dialed her mother next. "When the phone rang," Beth Huguette told me, "I looked at my clock and it was 4:11 in the morning. There was this throaty sound on the other end of the line. Panicked sounds, with nothing coming out. I knew it was Allison, even without any words. I'll never forget it. I'll have that with me the rest of my life." "Mom," Allison eventually managed to blurt as she ran. "He's chasing me. Help me. Save me. Mom." Donaldson had somehow seen or heard Allison fleeing from the house and was pursuing her. I'd only been on the phone with my mom for a few seconds when all of a sudden I heard someone behind me and I realized Beau was chasing me, Allison said. A few seconds later, his hand brushed her back as he grasped at her from behind. I was literally screaming into the phone, "He raped me," right when I felt him grabbing at me. My mom was telling me, run, keep running. Allison knew that Donaldson owned several guns. As she tried to accelerate away from him, she said, I thought he was going to kill me. I thought for sure I was dead. Running even harder down the alley and frantically pushing Donaldson's hands away as he pulled at her, Allison ignored the pain as the gravel cut her bare feet. I was hitting him as I ran, she said. I don't know if I was actually speaking to him. I was just talking to my mom, and I was worried because the battery in my phone was low and I knew it was about to die. Through her own phone, over the sound of Allison sobbing and gasping to catch her breath, Beth could hear Donaldson say, No, Allison, stop. Come back, I'm sorry. Don't say anything, I'll make it all right. Come back to the house with me. His voice was so calm, said Beth, a high school teacher. That's the most chilling part of the whole thing, how calm he was, how hysterical she was, and how calm he was. It made my skin crawl. As she spoke with Allison, Beth Huggett threw on some clothes, got in her van, and started down South Avenue toward the university district at 60 miles an hour, all the while imploring, Run, Allison, run! And then Beth heard Allison say, He's not behind me anymore. Oh my God, he's not behind me. For some reason, Donaldson had stopped chasing her and turned around. I was shocked that Beau actually let me go, Allison remembered. I honestly assumed he had a gun and I was going to be shot. Even though he was no longer trying to catch her, Allison didn't stop running. Beth recalled that Donaldson lived somewhere near the university, but the university district is huge, and Allison didn't know the address of the house or even what street it was on. Eventually, however, Allison was able to communicate that she was near the soccer fields, which are located on South Avenue at Higgins, so Beth kept driving in that direction as fast as she dared. I was running barefoot, still trying to hold my pants up, said Allison, when I turned out of the alley and got onto South Avenue. And there was my mom. By this point, Allison's phone battery was dead, so she ran into the middle of the road and flagged Beth down. As soon as I saw her, I knew something bad had happened, Beth said. As she came toward me, she was hobbling and kind of falling. When she got in the van, she started rocking back and forth, crying hysterically. I flipped a U-turn and headed straight to community hospital. I knew she had been assaulted, I just didn't know to what extent. A couple of minutes after they'd turned around and were driving toward the hospital, Allison realized that Keeley Williams was still back inside Donaldson's house, sleeping, unaware of the danger she was in. Keeley! Allison screamed at her mother. We need to go back and get Keeley! As Beth reversed course and steered the van toward the house, Allison dialed Williams' number. Beau just raped me, she shouted into the phone when Williams answered. You have to get out. You have to get out right now. My mom and I are outside waiting for you. Williams grabbed her purse, put on her shoes, and fled. She was in such a hurry that she slammed her head into the edge of the back door in the dark, giving herself a black eye. I ran out of the garage and there they were. She told me. I jumped in the back of the van. Allison was sitting in the front, hunched over, crying. She wouldn't turn around. Seeing her like that, I started crying too and saying how sorry I was. As Williams recounted these events more than 2 years after the fact, she began to sob. I felt guilty because I was the one who wanted to go to the party and see our friends, she continued, tears streaming down her cheeks. I chose to drive. And then I drank too much to drive us home. And I left her on the couch alone because I wanted to sleep in a bed. If we had just left, or I had made her sleep with me, or I had slept with her on the couch, then it wouldn't have happened. I know I shouldn't feel guilty, but I do. How could I have left her out there? You left me out there, Allison answered, because neither of us had any reason to think we would be in danger in that house with those friends. We trusted them completely. Chapter 3. After Beth Huggett picked up Allison and Keeley Williams, she drove Allison to Missoula's Community Medical Center emergency room to receive treatment for her injuries. Because this hospital doesn't perform forensic examinations of rape victims, however, The staff at Community Medical sent Allison across town to the First Step Resource Center, the Sexual Assault Response Unit at St. Patrick Hospital, to have a rape kit collected. The United States Violence Against Women Act of 2005 requires that all victims of sexual assault be given free access to an evidence collection kit, better known as a rape kit. It consists of sterile swabs, small containers, plastic bags, microscope slides, and other implements for collecting and storing semen, blood, saliva, hairs, and clothing fibers that might be used as evidence in a criminal trial. For most victims, submitting to the procedures that allow such evidence to be gathered is an exceedingly humiliating experience. This was certainly true in Allison's case. After arriving at First Step, she says, "For the next 4 hours, I was essentially raped all over again. I had to stand completely naked on a white sheet and let a nurse brush my entire body to collect evidence that might contain Beau's DNA. Allison's most private recesses were probed, combed, swabbed, photographed, and intensely scrutinized by strangers. A nurse made a video of the inside of her vagina, documenting the flesh that had been torn when Donaldson violated her. The whole process, while absolutely necessary, was incredibly traumatic," Allison says, "even though the nurse and counselor tried to be comforting." It wasn't until 10 o'clock Saturday morning that Allison and Beth Huguette returned to Beth's home in Target Range. It had been a long night, but Allison didn't have the luxury of crawling into bed to sleep. Instead, she took a hot shower, dressed, and tried to pull herself together enough to meet her father, who was expecting her to attend the Grizz football game with him that afternoon. At the eastern edge of Missoula, Mount Sentinel towers 2,000 feet above the University of Montana campus. A third of the way up the mountainside, a white concrete M adorns the slope. 10 stories high, it's the city's most famous landmark. Directly below the M is Washington Grizzly Stadium. Allison's parents separated when she was 15 and eventually divorced. Although she had been living at her mother's house that summer, she remained close to her father, Kevin. He was a huge Grizz fan, and whenever Allison was in town on game day, they went to the stadium together to watch the team play. "I was born and raised in Missoula," Kevin Huguette told me. "Grizz football is a big deal here." When Kevin was a boy, his father would lead him and his 5 brothers a couple of 100 feet up the steep incline of Mount Sentinel to watch Grizzly football games. "We were a large family and didn't have any money," Kevin said, "but we could sit on the hill and watch for free." Ever since becoming the owner of a thriving local business, Kevin has been a corporate sponsor of Grizzly Athletics and a season ticket holder. "Football games are an all-day Missoula event," he said. 20,000-some people, you know, show up in the morning for tailgating. Allison and her father usually had breakfast at his house before heading to the game. But the morning after Beau Donaldson raped her, Allison wasn't ready to face her father over bacon and eggs, so she texted him to say she was going to skip breakfast and would simply meet him at the stadium shortly before the opening kickoff. He texted her back, urging her not to be late. Allison was in a bind. "My dad was the last person I wanted to know that I had been raped," she explained. "I was in a state of shock. I wasn't able to think or make decisions. I was just going through the motions. Mostly, at that point, I was trying to figure out how to make my eyes not look like I had been bawling for the past 5 hours." She put on sunglasses to hide her bloodshot eyes and went to Grizzly Stadium. Allison's extended family had tickets together on the 30-yard line for every game, less than a dozen rows up from the field. When she arrived, her grandfather was there, a couple of uncles, some cousins, and her father. The first thing Kevin said to her was, "Do you see Beau down there? Is he playing today? How's he doing?" "I don't know," Allison snapped. "Beau is trailer trash." Kevin, who had never heard her speak ill of Donaldson before, was taken aback, but he let the comment pass. On the far side of the field, Allison could see Donaldson standing on the sideline with his teammates, wearing a maroon game jersey with his number, 45, emblazoned across his chest in silver. Before halftime, Allison took leave of her dad to avoid having to look at the man who'd just raped her, and tried to find Keeley Williams, who'd said she would be at the game, Allison thought talking to Williams might make her feel a little better. As she was looking for Williams, Allison ran into Sam Erschler, the friend who had persuaded Williams and Huguette to spend the night at Donaldson's house instead of driving home. Erschler, one of Donaldson's oldest friends, had no idea that anything was wrong. "I don't know why or how it came out," Allison recalled, "but I told him Beau raped me." "I'm sorry, Al," Erschler offered, giving her a hug. He told Huguette that Donaldson had been acting strange when they woke up that morning. Then, looking bewildered, Erschler said, "I don't know what's going on with Beau these days." Huguette walked off, located Williams, and the two women went to an out-of-the-way corner of the stadium to talk. There, they were soon approached by two young UM students hoping to get friendly. "These two boys were hitting on us," Huguette told me. "They thought they were being funny and would not go away." Keeley finally had to yell at them, "You need to leave us alone right now. I'm serious." After their would-be suitors departed, Huguette and Williams spent the rest of the football game talking about what had happened at Donaldson's house. While trying to explain why she felt so guilty about allowing Huguette to sleep alone on the couch, Williams told Huguette a secret she had shared with only a few other people. 2 years earlier, when she had left Montana to attend Portland State University, she, too, had been raped by an acquaintance. It happened during Williams's first week in Oregon, before classes had even started. It was orientation week, she remembered. "I hated it. I didn't do anything. I didn't make any friends. I didn't want to be there. I just wanted to sit in my room. I wished I'd never left Missoula." Then, Lewis Ronan, pseudonym, a boy she'd known slightly in high school who was also a student at Portland State, called and invited her to a party at his apartment. "Sweet," Williams thought. "Someone I know." It was a small gathering. When Williams arrived, Ronan's friends were smoking marijuana with a hookah. Williams began gulping down drinks. "I got really drunk," she said, "and started throwing up, a lot, from drinking too fast. A girl I didn't know was hanging out in the bathroom with me, helping take care of me and being nice." The girl offered to drive Williams back to her dormitory, but she was puking too much to travel anywhere. So Williams remained in Ronan's bathroom with the girl, resting her chest against the rim of the toilet bowl, between paroxysms of vomiting. As Williams's retching subsided, the girl repeatedly offered to drive Williams home, but Lewis Ronan intervened each time, insisting, "No, she'll just stay here tonight." Eventually, Williams agreed to spend the night at Ronan's, she remembered. "But I was really drunk, so I didn't really have a choice. And then I passed out. I don't even remember going to Lewis's room, but at some point later in the night I woke up in his bed and..." William stopped speaking for a moment as she began to cry. "And he was above me, and he was having sex with me," she continued between sobs. "And then I passed out again. When I woke up the next day, I had no idea where I was or how to get back to the university campus. I told Lewis I needed to get home because my mom was coming to visit me." Ronan didn't acknowledge that he had done anything wrong. He acted like everything was fine as he drove Williams back to her dorm. "I didn't really put it together that I had been raped, not at first," she said. When Williams's mother arrived, Keeley said nothing about what had happened. "I just kept begging her to take me home to Missoula," she explained through her tears. "I told her, I want to go home. I don't want to be here. I don't want to go to college. I don't want to be in Portland." Her mother had no idea why Keeley was so miserable. She was like, "No, you have to stay. You haven't even been here a week." Later that day, Keeley Williams was made painfully aware that her urinary tract had become inflamed during the forced intercourse that had taken place while she was passed out. Not wanting to tell her mother, she went to a local Safeway and bought cranberry juice and peridium to treat the inflammation. "It turned my pee bright orange," she recalled, "but it numbed my bladder, which helped." Williams spent most of the next couple of days drinking cranberry juice in bed. Purple bruises spread across her chest where she pressed against the toilet while throwing up. Meanwhile, Lewis Ronan began sending text messages to Williams's phone, indicating that he very much wanted to see her again, apparently unaware that she hadn't found it pleasurable to be raped while unconscious. Every time he texted me, I just felt nauseous, Williams told me. It made me want to vomit. I did not want him to tell me he wanted to hang out with me or ask me why I didn't want to talk to him. I wasn't consciously thinking, this guy raped me, because at the time, I didn't understand that if you don't actively consent to have sex, it's rape. I just knew something wasn't right. Eventually, it occurred to Williams that maybe Ronan had indeed raped her. So I looked some things up, she said, and realized that's what had happened. But I still didn't understand why somebody I knew would do that, like maybe I had said something, or maybe I did something. Not unlike many other rape victims, Williams initially reacted by wondering if she was somehow to blame. By now, a little bit of time had passed, Williams said. I just wanted it to go away. I didn't know what I should do or who I should tell. I didn't want anyone to ask me questions about it. I didn't want to talk about it. I knew that if I told someone who was really close to me that they would worry and ask me questions and would want me to do something about it, and I didn't want to deal with any of that. So I told this ex-boyfriend that I thought I had been raped. The ex-boyfriend didn't believe Keeley and became angry. He told her, "You're just being a slut. You're fucking other guys, and you're trying to cover that up by saying you were raped." 2 years after Lewis Ronan raped Keeley Williams, when Beau Donaldson raped Allison Huguette in September 2010, the trauma Williams had experienced came rushing back to the surface. As she and Huguette talked in a high corner of Grizzly Stadium the morning after Huguette was violated, Williams explained to her friend that part of the reason she felt so guilty about leaving Huguette alone on the couch at Donaldson's house was that it was all too easy for her to imagine what Huguette was going through, especially when she'd been curled into a ball, sobbing uncontrollably, in the front seat of her mother's van. "I wanted to absorb all of your pain," Williams told Huguette. "I wanted to hurt for you so you wouldn't have to deal with what I went through." The fact that Williams empathized intensely with Huguette could not and did not mitigate Huguette's pain, however. Huguette had been raped, and sooner or later she was going to have to come to grips with it. So she and Williams discussed how she might begin to do that. "I didn't feel like I was strong enough to go to the police," Huguette said, "or even tell my dad about it." She really wanted Donaldson to acknowledge what he had done to her, though. She and Williams decided that Huguette would ask Donaldson's friend, Sam Urschler, to tell Donaldson that he needed to come to Huguette's house and apologize, and that if he refused, she was going to report him to the police. Williams convinced Huguette that if Donaldson agreed to meet with her, she should surreptitiously make an audio recording of his apology. Williams was majoring in criminal justice at Portland State University, and she knew that according to Montana's stringent privacy laws, it is illegal to record a conversation unless all parties have been informed that they are being recorded. But even though it would be inadmissible in court, Williams argued to Huguette, "You have to make a recording, because you don't know if you will ever admit to this again." Huguette agreed. "I had no desire to talk to Beau," she said, "and at that point I had no intention of reporting him to the police. But Beau didn't know that. Threatening to go to the police was the only way I thought I had any power to make him acknowledge what he did. And if I ever did decide to go to the police or tell anyone else about what happened, I did not want to have to fight about whether Beau really raped me or not. I wanted to be able to prove it." So Saturday afternoon, following the Grizz game, Huguette went to Radio Shack with her mother and bought a digital recorder for $45. Beau Donaldson and Sam Urschler came to Beth Huguette's home Sunday afternoon. Both Allison and her mother were still extremely upset. Before Donaldson and Urschler arrived, Allison Huguette had turned on the recorder and jammed it between the cushions of her mother's sectional sofa. Donaldson happened to sit right next to it. As soon as Donaldson sat down, Allison asked him, "Do you want to apologize to me, Beau, or..." Donaldson answered, I'm just so sorry." Speaking in nervous bursts, he said, "We were, like, on the couch. I was obviously completely fucked up. We were both drunk. I mean, we were laying there. I remember we were making out on the couch. We were laying on the couch together, started doing stuff, and then it was just... I don't even really remember anything after, like, I remember we were making out. Furious that Donaldson would lie to her face and think he could get away with it, Allison demanded, Bo, how come I remember falling asleep on the couch and then I remember waking up halfway through realizing you're on top and having sex with me? Bo, I was asleep. We were making out on the couch, Donaldson insisted. No, we weren't, Allison replied just as vehemently. The issue, said Beth Huget, is that it was sex without consent. The issue, Bo, Allison angrily interjected, is that you took complete advantage of me. I did, Donaldson confessed. Suddenly, he seemed to understand that lying wasn't going to work. I admit it. I did. I'm sorry. Less than 2 minutes after Donaldson arrived, Allison had the confession she'd sought, but the conversation was far from over. The only reason I even felt comfortable sleeping there is because I've known you since the first grade, said Allison. I know, said Bo, and I can't blame it on alcohol because that's not right. It's something that I did, and I fucked up. Allison asked him, Has this happened before? No, never, Donaldson sobbed. This is the first time anything has ever happened to me like this, ever. I am so sorry. Beth reminded Donaldson that he had betrayed the trust of someone who considered him to be her big brother. Through his tears, Donaldson agreed. She's my little sister. If she ever had an issue, she'd come to you guys, Beth continued, referring to Donaldson and Sam Erschler. If she ever felt like a guy was treating her wrong, you guys are the people she would turn to. Allison reminded Donaldson that she had always supported him and spoken highly of him to others, at which point Donaldson broke down and began to cry uncontrollably. Do you know that you tore her up inside? Beth Huget asked. You cut her inside, in her vagina. Do you know how devastating that is? As a mother, that kills me. To think that she was physically violated that way, that's so low. Bo, Allison said, I just wish you knew what it was like to be a girl and to wake up and have this 230-pound person on your back taking advantage of you when you're not even awake. And then I just had to lay there until you were done. Allison told Donaldson, I would probably kill myself if this ever happened to another girl and I didn't say something to the police. Donaldson said he understood. I just about killed myself that night, he claimed. After he quit chasing Allison down the alley, he said, I curled up in my truck in the carport with my fucking handgun in my hand. Allison and her mother were dubious about the sincerity of his remorse. I don't know if you guys know about this, Beth Huget said. But Allison had a cyst rupture when she was 10 years old. She was in and out of doctors, and because of that, she takes her intimacy very seriously. She is not somebody that sleeps around. She is not promiscuous. Not that that would give you the right to rape her, that's not the point. It's just that we were at the hospital for hours. The fact that you cut her up inside and everything? Allison, I'm so fucking sorry, Donaldson wailed. If I hadn't grown up with you, Allison said, if I wasn't one of your friends, if you had done this to some random girl and she walks down to the police station and tells them, your whole life is ruined, Bo. Can't you just see the front page of the Missoulian? Another Grizzly football player in trouble, rapes girl. Do you need help? Do you need alcohol help? Do you need help with drugs? Because obviously this is a problem. Do you like your girlfriend? I love her more than anything, Donaldson answered. I want to be married to this girl. I don't understand, said Allison. If you love her, why are you cheating on her? Because I'm aware it's not just me. Among their circle of friends, Donaldson's infidelities were common knowledge. You really need to look hard into your life, Beth scolded, and take stock, and think of how you need to improve on it. I guess our concern is, and tell me if I'm wrong here, Allison, one of the things that makes her want to go to the police on this, Bo, is the fact that she doesn't want this to ever happen to another girl. She doesn't want to know a month or two from now that you violated some other girl, and that by her speaking out she could have stopped it. Allison, Donaldson sobbed. I'm so sorry. The thing is, Allison explained, I have a boyfriend who I have a lot of feelings for as well. This is something I can't even talk to him about. I can't bring this up to him. He would literally come back here and probably kill you. Honestly, if I hear of one incident, Beau, if I hear about any female ever saying that you touched them, I will go right to the police. Beth Huggett urged Donaldson to get therapy. You need to really talk to somebody and say, this is what I did, how do I change myself? And make sure this never happens to another person. I obviously fucking need some help, Donaldson agreed, no longer crying. I'm so sorry. Allison reminded Donaldson, if I walked down to the police station right now, it would ruin your life. And that's why I'm not going to do it. I don't want to have to live with that. But I'm not okay with what happened. I'm not telling you that by not going out and filing charges that it was okay, because it wasn't. It needs to never happen again. Get help, Beau. Donaldson assured her that he would. He promised me that he would get treatment for his drug, alcohol, and sexual issues, Allison recalled. And I made it clear that this promise was the only reason I wasn't going to the police. Chapter 4. A few days after it happened, Beth Huggett told me, I remember Allison sitting on the couch down in the basement of my house, wrapped in blankets. She wasn't saying anything, but you could see it looping in her mind. You could see it in her face. I was overwhelmed, Allison remembered. Classes for her junior year at Eastern Oregon University were due to start in a few days, she said. But I wasn't ready to leave the security of my home. I wanted to be near my family and feel protected by them. She decided to remain in Missoula for the semester and take all her classes online. Then, a week after being raped, she got a phone call from her younger sister Kathleen, who was attending college in Boise, Idaho. Kathleen Huggett told Allison that a mutual acquaintance was informing people that you and Beau had sex last weekend. Kathleen didn't even bother asking Allison if the rumor was true because she knew it was preposterous. Beau Donaldson was the last person in the world Allison would ever sleep with. In high dudgeon, Kathleen reported that she had sent their acquaintance a nasty Facebook message commanding her to stop spreading ridiculous rumors. I was sitting there in shock when Kathleen told me this, Allison said. I couldn't even process it. Donaldson and his friend Sam Urschler had assured Allison and her mother that they would say nothing about the rape to anyone, yet a rumor that she had willingly slept with her rapist was already circulating in Missoula, Montana, Boise, Idaho, and La Grande, Oregon. Allison said nothing to Kathleen about the rape. Instead, she called Keeley Williams for commiseration, telling her, I can't believe this. Then she thumbed a text to Beau Donaldson to let him know what people were saying about them. She warned, I can promise you that if I hear one more person saying that I slept with you, I am going to the police. Donaldson immediately texted her back, saying that although he had no idea who was responsible for the rumor, he would shut it down and get it taken care of. The text from Donaldson seemed genuinely contrite. Allison Huggett found it surprisingly reassuring. It gave her a sense of control, or at least an illusion of control, that continued for more than a year. At the time, she told me, I felt I had some real leverage, so I wasn't so scared of him. And I had confidence he would really seek the help he needed. Huggett convinced herself that as long as nobody knew she had been raped, she could resume living as if it had never happened, and everything would return to normal. She didn't see any reason to seek psychotherapy. That next year turned out to be weird for me, she said. I can't remember if I thought much about the rape or didn't think about it during that period. I can't remember if I was sleeping okay or having nightmares. That whole period is kind of blank. I'm pretty sure I managed to just keep it out of my mind. That semester, she recalled, I was working full-time for my dad at Office Solutions. I studied a lot and did well with my online classes, and on weekends I would go to Pullman sometimes. Two of Huggett's closest friends from EOU had graduated and moved to Pullman, Washington, a college town. When Huggett visited, she and her friends hit the bars. I was drinking a lot more than usual that year, she said. drinking and partying, having a good time. Looking back, I see that I was making some bad decisions. And looking back, now I know why I was making those bad decisions. But at the time, I wasn't willing to accept the fact that Beau had changed me in that way.